Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. That breaking news from the Supreme Court is actually going to be relevant to our next guest. You know about Russian hacking in the 2016 election, but the potential harm of cyber weaponry extends far beyond election meddling. The electrical grid, the U.S. military, and private industry all stand as targets, already with some Russian and other successes. And back now with us is David Sanger, New York Times national security correspondent. He's got a new book called The Perfect Weapon: War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. We will also talk to him about the Trump-Kim U.S.-North Korea summit, which he covered in Singapore last week, and the follow-up from that. So hi, David Sanger. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be with you, Brian.
Let's start on the breaking news. Supreme Court ruling that prosecutors or the FBI need some kind of warrant to look at people's cell phones and particularly track their whereabouts via their cell phones. Does this relate to some of the themes of your book?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's a fascinating decision because if you listen to the FBI, they would tell you that they were at risk of going into sort of a blackout period where they feared that they couldn't get digital data. And you remember, for example, the battle with Apple over encrypted data on an iPhone during their efforts to get that kind of information. And that sort of ended in a standoff. But that was part, as this case is, of a whole broad class of cases that have to do with how well FBI, police, and others, how easily they can get into all of the digital dust that we leave behind. And I actually never believed the FBI argument here about how they were going into a dark era. In fact, it has been a golden age of surveillance for American law enforcement because almost everything we have done has made it easier for the government to track Americans, whether it is the cell phone that's emitting locations to towers, which was the subject of this case, or every time your EasyPass goes through a toll booth and leaves a digital record of where your car is, and pretty good likelihood that you're driving it, or what your Alexa can tell you, can tell people at home about what you're searching for. So there's a vast wealth of data now available that was never available before. And this was a very major step in the Supreme Court saying, slow down, folks. Think just because we are sharing that data between the cell phone user and the provider of the cell phone service, whether it's AT&T or Verizon or whether it's Google or whatever it is, if the government wants it, the fact that you're sharing it with your provider does not give the government a right to get it without a full warrant.
The DNC hack from 2016. You report in the book that every time our government considered a response to that meddling, they backed off, according to former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper. Did our government feel its hands were tied from doing anything in response when they knew the Russians were hacking our election?
You know, Brian, as I went in to do the reporting for The Perfect Weapon, what struck me was that our government messed up the investigation at several different levels. So before the DNC hack even happened, the Russians had gone into the State Department, the Pentagon, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the White House unclassified systems, mostly just pulling out emails and other data. And in each case, the U.S. government saw them and fought them to get them out and never publicly identified them and never imposed any sanction. And so Vladimir Putin quickly came to the conclusion, I think, that if you're not going to fight
fire with
penalize
fire.
Russia over the White House who would care about the Democratic National Committee, which is essentially, you know, staffed by college kids, right? And he was right. And then when the Russians were found inside the DNC, the president made the decision that if he retaliated, he ran the risk, and it was a reasonable understanding, he ran the risk that the Russians would come back and escalate on election day. And that completely froze the U.S. government for months at a time when they could have actually been sending a message that was pretty strong.
We could say that Donald Trump, as president, has a more retaliatory nature on lots of things than Barack Obama did as president. He tried to exercise a lot of restraint in all kinds of affairs like that, whether that worked to the advantage of the country or not. Do you see the Trump administration doing or likely to do, depending on what they were to find that Russia or another country were doing, retaliate in a different way than Obama did?
Well, the initial retaliation that President Obama ultimately did, only after the election, was throwing out 35 diplomats who were truly spies and closing some consulates and recreational facilities. And the book reveals that one of them out in Long Island was believed by American intelligence to be a base from which the Russians were digging down underneath the property that they had there to get into a major communications trunk line that happened to run underground under their facility. So that was another reason they closed it. But in the end, what the president did was basically throw people out of the country. And I quote in the book a senior member of the Obama administration as saying somewhat wryly that this was the perfect 19th century response to a 21st century problem.
Right. And wasn't it those exact responses that Michael Flynn wound up lying to the FBI about talking to the Russians about, just as Obama was imposing them?
That's right. That's what he got caught on. And what's happened since is that the Trump administration, somewhat over the objections of the president, had to go out and actually do more sanctions against the Russians. First for that hack, they did that a few months ago, and then in response to the Russian participation in an attack on Ukraine that ended up spreading far beyond Ukraine and became the most expensive hack in world history. It cost about $1 billion in damage, shipping companies, others. That was called NotPetya, and it was one of two major hacks last year. The other one, of course, was done by North Korea, and as the book describes, was done using weapons that had been stolen from the United States government, from the NSA, and shot back at our allies. And no one has paid a price for that.
I don't remember cyber weapons being mentioned in the Trump-Kim summit. Did I miss something?
You didn't miss a thing. They weren't. And I made that point a few times in the Times and in some broadcasts. And it's interesting because it tells you, you know, the president was focused on nuclear weapons, and as somebody who's covered the nuclear issues in North Korea for many decades, I think it was completely understandable that he needed to take away that threat. But there was also a little bit of a sense that they were ignoring how time had marched on and how the North Koreans have come to the conclusion that cyber is actually a much more useful weapon to them than nuclear is. And I argue in the book, in many ways, it's the opposite of nuclear, and that's why we're having such a hard time deterring it, because you can dial it up and dial it down. It's hard to see where it's coming from, and it's usually used in short of war exercises so that the United States is not going to turn around and threaten to destroy another country because they did a cyber attack on Sony Pictures or stole money, as the North Koreans have, out of the Central Bank of Bangladesh through the New York Fed. It's a much more useful weapon, even if it doesn't do the kind of broad damage that nuclear does.
My guest is David Sanger, New York Times national security correspondent. We're talking about issues in the news relative to his beat, relevant to his beat, and his new book, The Perfect Weapon, War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. And we can take a few phone calls at 212-433 WNYC, 212-433-9692. I'm going to ask you in a minute if you learned anything in the course of your research that Robert Mueller might like to know that's, you know, relevant to Trump World's involvement with Russia in any of this cyber hacking that you discovered from the last few years. But I want you first to give a sense of the scope of what you discovered to our listeners. I mean, just the flap of the book says we hear about the DNC hack, but within that same year, 2016, the Russians not only had broken into networks at the White House, the State Department, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, but had placed implants in American electrical and nuclear power plants that could give them the power to switch off vast swaths of the country. Can the Russians do that today if they so choose?
Well, they certainly have the implants in place, and the Department of Homeland Security issued a warning about 2 or 3 months ago, just as I was closing the book, that affirmed everything that I had learned in the course of the reporting. The difficulty we have here, in part, is that when countries put an implant into a computer system, you know the implant's there, but you don't know their intent. And the same implant can be used. It's basically just malware. Think of it like the port that a doctor might put in, where they can go in to probe to see what's happening in your body, but they can also use the same port to deliver chemotherapy. Well, in the case of the implant, you can use it for surveillance or you can use it to deliver malware. And that's always, of course, our fear that in some kind of time of tension or conflict, they would go and unplug the country. So you'd think to yourself, well, if we were going to have arms control here in the world of cyber, we'd reach an agreement that people don't put implants in, you know, each other's critical infrastructure, whether it's the election system or the electricity grid or cell phones for emergency responders or for hospitals, things that we would all agree would make civilians the collateral damage in these cyber wars. And if the first group that would object to that and has internally is U.S. intelligence agencies, because we put implants in tens, if not hundreds of thousands, of computer networks around the world. The book reveals the details of a secret U.S. program called Nitro Zeus, which was designed to basically unplug Iran if we got into a conflict with Iran. Now, it was avoided by the 2015 nuclear agreement, the one President Trump has abandoned. But the plan, which was a huge one involving thousands of people designing it, was one to basically try to win a war by unplugging a country before a single shot was fired. And so we're using these kind of plans, and so are our adversaries.
And what about anything you may have learned with respect to Russia's hacking of the elections in any way? In particular, you were trying to write a book with a big global view of cyber warfare. You weren't doing a criminal investigation of people connected to Donald Trump. But did you run across anything?
Well, there are four chapters about the Russia hack. And the first one actually starts in Ukraine, because everything the Russians did to us in 2016, they tested out in Ukraine. And Brian, the chapter is called Putin's Petri Dish.
Yep.
Because that's what Ukraine was. And so the first thing I came to the conclusion of was, shame on us that while we saw all this happening in Ukraine, we did not have the imagination that it could be taken here. Then I pace you through all of the different things they were doing as they were building up the Internet Research Agency and, of course, doing the hack itself. One of the big revelations of the book is that the main Russian intrusion, the one that resulted in the publication of all those DNC emails, was detected not initially by us, but by the British, by GCHQ, the people who back in World War II did the Enigma machines. And they were the ones who sort of called up the NSA and say, you know, we're plugged into the Russian military intelligence and we're seeing DNC documents out here. But I did not find any particular evidence that there were members of the campaign who were colluding on the question of timing. That doesn't mean the evidence isn't there, but I didn't find any evidence that they were the ones sort of directing what the GRU was doing or how they were publishing it.
Brian in the Bronx, you're on WNYC with David Sanger. Hi, Brian.
Hey, good morning. First time caller, Brian. How you doing?
Glad you're in. Thank you.
Hi, good morning, David. David, I got two quick questions for you. I remember right when Obama was about to leave office, he said that he was going to punish Russia. One of the ways we might see one of the punishment, and the other way we mightn't see. And did we have a Russian spy right in Mr. Putin's circle? Because, you know, we heard that maybe right around before he left, President Obama left office, we heard like somebody disappear, or, you know, somebody like that was in the circle. But could you comment on that? I'll listen up here.
Two very good questions. So on the question of whether there was someone inside the circle, it appears that there was, because a lot of the evidence that tied Putin to directly ordering the DNC hack, which was the conclusion of the U.S. intelligence, appeared to come from a source so sensitive that they wouldn't even put the name of the source or the type of source into the presidential daily brief. It showed up in sealed white envelopes that the CIA director at the time, John Brennan, was bringing over to the White House, and that was how sensitive that particular source appeared to be. On your second question, whether or not we did something additional, there was some code that President Obama ordered be put into the Russian systems that would be important to them. But it doesn't appear from my reporting that it did any damage. It was kind of a Kilroy was there kind of thing, in which they basically said, we can get into your systems too, so watch your step. The big question for the Russians is, do they believe that Donald Trump would do that as well? And since they heard President Trump declare the other day that he wanted Russia back in NATO, I think it's reasonable for them to ask the question, do they really think that's a serious threat?
Wait, Russia back in NATO? Russia was never in NATO, was it?
I'm sorry. Back in the you caught me absolutely right. Into the G7, and of course, what I was thinking of was the president getting ready to go to NATO to describe this. But thank you, Brian. Yes, what he said was he wanted Russia back into the G7 and all the other G7 members who had participated in getting the Russians out. After the annexation of Crimea, said, are you kidding? And would not go off and do it. There's a lot of nervousness coming ahead of the NATO meeting, which is going to be the second week of July, and we're expecting the president to go, because the NATO members are afraid that the president's going to give up too much to the Russians at a time that the Russians have been increasingly aggressive to them, and might not fully support the kind of NATO operations that have been going on in the countries surrounding Russia that are sort of the former Soviet states that are the newer members of NATO.
Linda in Rockley, New Jersey, you're on WNYC with New York Times national security correspondent David Sanger. Hi, Linda.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Mr. Sanger, I do have a question. I briefly saw something on the news in regards to people when they go to the airports, they're going to have them take pictures of them or something. You know, as Americans, we have driver's licenses. They have all our information. Are we walking the thin line into going into cataloging people, which is back into the fascist area?
Well, it's an interesting question. I don't know what you're referring to right now, but in most airports and public areas and a lot of streets of New York and certainly the streets of London and other heavily surveilled places. I was just in Singapore, another one of these. There are cameras everywhere, and these are being used for facial recognition purposes as well. And the courts have so far ruled that if you're out in public, you know, the fact that your image is recorded on a camera is, you know, not a violation. But of course, big data enables you now to go track a lot more people from facial recognition and so forth as you move around. That's not really what the court case that got ruled on today by the Supreme Court was about. The court today was dealing with the question of when you sign up to a new technologic convenience, like having your cell phone around, can the government basically say, since you're giving that information freely to your cell phone provider or to Google or others by using Google Maps, does that mean the government can get at it without getting a full warrant? And the answer today was no, they can't.
We just have a few minutes left. In the book, you remind us of the U.S. and Israel mounting a cyber attack a decade ago on Iran's nuclear centrifuges. I think that was called Operation Olympic Games.
That's right.
And there have been American attacks on North Korea's missile system. And so, as you said earlier in our conversation, the U.S. is often the cyber aggressor on the international stage, as well as the cyber victim, if you will, with some of these operations that you've laid out, especially on the part of Russia and North Korea. So what should the future hold, in your opinion? I mean, if there have been nuclear weapons, anti-nuclear proliferation treaties and things like that, do we need some kind of international treaty system to control the spread of cyber weapons, or doesn't it lend itself to the same kind of thing?
It's a very good question, Brian, and I don't think it lends itself to the same kind of thing. In nuclear, there were a limited number of states that had nuclear weapons and that could get them because they're very expensive to get and because you need plutonium or uranium to get them. Cyber weapons are the opposite. They're very easy to get. All you need is some inexpensive computing power, some good coding, young talent, a lot of time, maybe a few cases of Red Bull to keep everybody awake while they're doing it. But the barrier to entry is very low, and that's why there are 30 or 40 countries now that have significant cyber power. But we only have 9 nuclear armed states at this point. And I don't believe treaties will work here because the weapons are not simply in the hands of states. They're in the hands of criminal groups. They're in the hands of terrorists. They're in the hands of teenagers. So who would sign on to those treaties? So instead, I think the effort has been to move to some international norms. And that was making some progress through the United Nations until last summer when the Chinese and the United States couldn't come to any particular agreements. Two things worry me about this. One is that we have such reflexive secrecy around our own cyber capability that the U.S. government will not sort of step up to this issue and deal with what it is we'd be willing to give up. The second big worry that I have about this is that the Trump administration has not done a very good job of keeping itself organized on these cyber issues. When John Bolton came in as the National Security Advisor, the first thing he did was eliminate the position of the White House Cyber Security Coordinator, the one who was supposed to bring some rationality to all that's going on in the Department of Defense, the Department of Homeland Security, all the other departments that are dealing with the cyber issues. He not only sent the person involved back to the NSA, he then got rid of the job. And it strikes me that this is a White House that hasn't focused on this fully, which is amazing considering that the intelligence community has said for the past 4 or 5 years, it is the number one threat facing the United States, ahead of terrorism, ahead of nuclear proliferation. And yet it seems to me that this administration is not sufficiently focused on that.
Well, sounds like there's going to be a lot of follow-up reporting in the New York Times on this after that conclusion by David Sanger, New York Times national security correspondent and the author now of The Perfect Weapon, War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. David, thank you so much.
Great to be back with you, Brian.